Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets, a family podcast of pirates and penguins. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
To start this week, we have some listener feedback we wanted to play for all of you. And Melanie hasn't heard this yet, so this will be for Melanie first. To share with all of you. And this is from our friend Zena.
Hello, it's your friend Zena from not that far away in Boston. And I just wanted to say happy birthday, Melanie, and give you this little bit of feedback. So anyway, yeah, it's Sunday, August 2nd, and I believe it's Melanie's birthday. So I want to wish you the best. Okay, love your podcast.
Aw.
That was very nice.
That was very sweet.
So, as Zena let us all know, that today is Melanie's birthday as we record. And so, happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
How was your birthday?
Very good. Thank you.
What'd you do? How was your... That's sort of a lead-in, you know.
But sorry. I missed that clue.
We've only been married for how many years?
No, it was great. Went to Mass with the three of the kids and then came home and, just kind of took it easy.
Took it easy. You, you made... What did you cook? You made...
I made a cake.
You made a cake.
A carrot cake with cream cheese frosting.
We'll talk about that in a bit.
Yum.
And,
I talked to my sister. I talked to my mom. I read a book. Took a nap.
Okay.
You know.
Yeah.
What one does.
Well, I mean, it sounds like a good birthday. It was low key. I mean, these days, there's not much we can do. It's not like we can go places.
Right.
But you usually have a low key birthday anyway, right?
Right.
Last year you were able to go into the city? Or was that a couple years ago?
I don't remember.
I forget now.
Yeah, it all blurs together.
It does. I mean, occasionally you get a chance to go out, or like either you go into the city by yourself.
No, I think last year I not into the city, but I went and took myself out for brunch at Red Eye Roasters.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Walked along the pier.
Right. But again, this is not something.
No, not really.
These days.
I mean, I suppose I could have driven down there and got coffee and walked on the beach or something.
Yeah. Well, in any case, you got some presents.
I did. Let's see. What did I get? You gave me a beautiful set of plates that I've been wanting.
Yes.
Really pretty blue and.
You got like almost an Italian design on it.
Yeah. They feel very Italian.
Yeah.
And a set of watercolors. Very nice.
Watercolor paints. Portable set.
Yes.
Just in time for vacation.
My parents sent me a beautiful print of Our Lady Undoer of Knots by the artist Daniel Mitsui, whose work I've long admired.
He's a great Catholic artist.
Brilliant Catholic artist. We're so lucky that he sells his prints and does beautiful work.
Yep.
So I'm very thrilled about that. I've got a... my mom also sent money for me to get it framed. So,
oh, nice.
So I have to go to the store and find a frame for it.
Oh, go out to a store.
Yeah.
So, yes, not only are you an introvert, but you also have the mask.
Although there's a few other things that I wouldn't mind getting. I've come across a need for some ribbon. In the last week, so I suppose that going to like a craft store like Michael's that might have frames and ribbons.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, could make an expedition of it. Kill a few birds with one stone.
Right.
Or something like that.
The kids did their usual wishing happy birthday, making cards.
I, Ben made me a card. Everybody else kind of forgot and didn't seem to feel a need to, like, remedy that.
If I'm not behind them driving them like a herd of sheep toward the goal.
Yeah, pretty much.
They kind of forget. I mean, they love you and they tell you. Although this morning I had to go around and reminding them, remember, it's your mother's birthday.
I was kind of hoping, actually, for a really cool Star Wars card by Isabella and Sophia, like the one you got.
Yep.
Oh, well.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure they think that I love Star Wars, therefore I want a Star Wars card. But you want a Star Wars card from them because they love Star Wars,
right?
And I don't think they understood that.
Yeah.
Oh well,
it's okay.
It was
very nice day.
That's good. Otherwise, relatively quiet.
Oh, and then we ordered.
Oh yes,
we ordered takeout from Indian place that is really good.
Mm.
So we got chicken tikka masala, chicken curry, chicken
korma.
Yeah.
And tandoori chicken, lots of chicken.
And lots of chicken.
Varying tastes, varying ability, desires to try spicy and or unusual flavors.
And some samosas and something like an appetizer platter that had like a whole bunch of different
stuff had never tried before, which was really good.
Yeah. That I love trying like the big sampler platter sorts of things where you get lots of little things that you can try.
We were talking about that at dinner. Like when you go, like the first, both of us, our first experiences at Indian restaurants, but, and separately, of course, you were a kid. I think you went with your mom and I was in college. It was a buffet, an Indian buffet, and which is a great idea because if you go and you have to order a thing of a menu and you don't know what any of the things are, it's hard to choose.
It is hard to choose. And what if the one thing that you would get is the one thing that you don't like on the menu?
Like you could possibly mistakenly order goat curry.
Oh,
yeah. Remember that time we were at Las Colinas in Dallas?
We discovered that we did not like goat. We were adventuresome.
Yes.
We did try the goat.
We tried it. It was on a buffet, right? I think it was on a buffet. I don't think I would have ordered, like, this is my meal. I'm trying goat.
No, it wasn't like a order, this is your meal, but I think that, I don't remember serving it from a buffet. I think it was more like a...
We got a bunch of stuff in common with the people we were with?
No, I think it was more like one of those, like, sampler platter sort of meals where they brought you lots and lots of little bowls.
Yeah, that might have been it.
I think that was it.
But yeah, that's the only time I would have ordered something like that. I mean, it's great. So let's try a thing, you know, give it a shot. What do you get to lose? You get other stuff you can try. So that's a great way to try new foods and to learn what you like. When we went to the Addis Red Sea, the Ethiopian restaurant in Boston, I think the first time I went, you'd been there before.
I had.
But the first time I went, it was a matter of, okay, what do I get? And everybody just kind of ordered something different. And so I ordered something that no one else had ordered. That looks kind of cool. And then it all gets put into the big platter in front of me.
Right, right. It's, yeah.
Traditional Ethiopian.
It's all served family style, essentially.
Yeah, there's I think we've talked about Ethiopian, the Addis Red Sea before. But they lay the injera bread, flatbread, on the big table before you, and then they dump the platters of food onto it in front of each person, so it's all right there, and then you can
you pick up the stewy sorts of food with your pieces of bread and eat it.
And if you're with utensils. And if you're with friends, you can try everybody else's because it's all right there. But yeah, I think that's a great way of doing it. But it was really good. We both realized we ate too much.
I ate way too much. Oh, yeah. My gosh, I feel so full right now.
So it was your birthday, which was nice. Then what else? We really didn't do anything this week again. We'll have stuff we'll have done in the future. Like next time you talk to us, we'll have done something.
Right.
You'll see. Baby bunny update. I need baby bunny update theme. Music,
right, yeah.
Because we talked about I saw the mother bunny of the backyard. Is there a word for that? Like mare? Like
doe.
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 Really? A bunny is a doe?
A female bunny is a doe.
Oh. So the doe has been around, and we've seen the babies bouncing around the yard.
We have. There were four of them.
Yes.
I only saw one, but the kids
have seen all four of them.
I've seen all four.
So there I am one morning this week, I think Thursday morning, getting ready. I was in the bathroom getting ready, and my phone rings, the cameras, the security cameras rings there's a person in the backyard. So it detects, it's supposed to detect people instead of animals or waving plants or in the wind. So there's this person in the backyard. I'm like, that's too early for someone to be in the backyard. So I call up the thing and I look at it and I see this cat racing from spot to spot in the yard. And I'm like, what's that cat doing? Oh my gosh, the bunnies. And so I run out of the bathroom. Oh, fling open the back door and go, I make the cat scat noise. And the thing's like, off the thing in the port. And I go out there and the poor like baby bunny is sitting there by the dome, shivering, not moving, like traumatized or whatever. Like it was just not going anywhere. I didn't know where the other bunnies were. But we're pretty sure they didn't get caught because I think the kids have seen the other bunnies.
We've seen some of them at least.
Yes.
I'm not sure if we've seen all four together.
The likelihood that all four bunnies are going to survive to adulthood is fairly
very
low.
Slim. The likelihood that any of them all survive to adulthood is fairly slim. Right, fairly
that's,
slim.
That's why bunnies breed like bunnies.
Yeah, but they're very cute. I mean, these are tiny little rabbits. Like they're the size of like
your
fist.
Hold one in the palm of your hand. Yeah.
They're really cute.
They're adorable. And the kids, though, are good about keeping their distance from them. I've really drilled into them, like, wild animals are wild animals, no matter how cute they look or how friendly they appear or tame. You have to remember that all wild animals are wild animals and they're unpredictable. Like, I learned that the hard way when I was a kid. But
yeah, watch out for the killer bunnies.
The killer bunny. What's it going to do near me, Bob?
Actually, the funny thing is that right now, Ben is listening to Watership Down, the audiobook.
Read by Peter Capaldi.
Read by Peter Capaldi, which I really want to... I started to listen to it the other day when I was cooking, and after a while, it got too chaotic, and I had to stop it. But Ben decided that he really wanted to hear the rest of the story, and so he started listening to the audiobook, and he's about 4 hours into it at this point.
So before he was Doctor Who, Peter Capaldi starred in this show, this British show, where he was like the political aide to some important politician, and he was this foul-mouthed, mean, but super effective political operative and very like funny with the rapier wit sort of thing, but he was so foul-mouthed. So when you've seen that and then hear him reading like Watership Down about rabbits and stuff, it's a little disconcerting. Although Watership Down is not a tame children's book.
It's not cutesy rabbits. I would not give it to a child younger than Ben, I don't think, but Ben's 11.
Yeah.
And he can deal with like slightly tougher, grittier stuff.
If they read Harry Potter, they can handle Watership Down.
Exactly. But it isn't for the faint of heart.
No.
There's rabbit on rabbit violence. Let's just say that.
Rabbit on rabbit violence.
It's true though.
Killer bunny rabbits.
It really is. I mean, killer bunny rabbits.
Run away.
Sorry, spoilers, but
yes.
Yeah, some things you need to kind of know.
Yeah.
And if you're expecting like Beatrix Potter rabbits, that's not where you're going to get.
Mm.
Unless you're thinking about like the fierce bad rabbit.
Yes. With the shoots the hunter.
I love the fierce bad rabbit. It is one of the funniest stories.
Yes. So the other thing, actually, we did go out a little bit this week. It was my brother's birthday this week, and he was going out on a boat. And so they asked if we would come over on Tuesday afternoon and hang out with my mom to make sure she's okay. My mom's elderly, and so it's good if someone hangs with her. She's fine, but it's good if someone's there with her to make sure she's okay. And then my dad, who lives with my other brother, found out we were going over to ask me, can you pick me up? I'd like to go over and visit. So sure. And so, but you went, I was still working, but you went with the kids.
So yeah, we picked up Nanu.
Yep.
And then we went over to your brother's house and the kids swam in the pool. And I know the old folks, because it was a really hot day, stayed inside watching TV and right. chatting
and,
with
and
each other.
There was a storm that came through too.
Yeah. Right. So we were outside until it started pouring.
Right. And then that's about when I came over.
Right. You were right just in time for the rain.
Well, for the rain to stop, because I came over and we went back out.
That's true.
It rained while I was driving over. So.
And then I fell asleep in the chair.
Yes. And my mom and dad were watching old westerns, like old TV westerns, like Gunsmoke.
No, they were watching The Rifleman, and then watched several episodes of The Rifleman, and then Wagon Train.
Wagon Train. Man, TV was different back then, wasn't it?
So very different.
And very moral-based, like about the morality tale.
Yeah, and it was just like... There was the Rifleman episode that we saw was like this whole, there's a jealous husband who is convinced that his wife is in love with this other guy.
The sheriff or somebody else?
No, some other guy. And he's just incredible. And then he thinks that she's after, what's his name? The Rifleman.
Right. I don't know his name.
I don't remember his name. Anyway, so it's just like very...
Well, Wagon Train was sort of like that. So the main character in Wagon Train, he's a Civil War veteran, and he went off to war. He'd left behind the love of his life, and then she turns out to be on the wagon train, this particular wagon train out heading west. And meanwhile, there's this other guy who showed up at the wagon train with her, who...
fought on the other side in the war.
Yes, and also is a jerk and has determined that he's going to make her his, whether she likes it or not, or anybody else. And it was like this whole weird, like, dude, like, what if she doesn't want to be with you?
He was very creepy.
And then he was like, yeah, he'd walk up to the main character and like, she's going to be mine no matter what you say. So back off. Like, oh, okay. Like
she doesn't get a say in this.
Yes. It was very, very weird, old fashioned sort of thing. Anyway, they all loved it. And the kids were like rats watching it. Like, oh, what is this? I don't think they've seen
anything like that before.
No. I mean, they've seen a couple of cowboy movies with me.
Right.
You know, a couple of John Wayne movies, but nothing like Gunsmoke, Rifleman or Wagon Train. I'd never seen Wagon Train before.
I hadn't either.
Although, what was it? Gene Roddenberry, when he was pitching Star Trek, described it as Wagon Train to the Stars.
Interesting.
Which is not really at all. Although, episodic with morality tales and that sort of going out to dangerous territories, I guess, a little bit.
Maybe.
But that was his original pitch anyway. It didn't really end up like that. But it was interesting. So it must have had a big impression because Lucy ended up writing a poem about it.
Right. The next day or the day after. I forget which day it was. She came to me and she said she had... We'd been reading some storybooks, and then she wandered off into her bedroom and was gone for about 10, 15 minutes, and then came back into the living room and said, I wrote a poem. And so I said, okay, you want me to write it down for you? Because she's still not great shakes at writing. And so I pulled out my laptop, and she dictated it to me. And
go ahead, read it.
Okay, I'll read it to you. I wish we had it in her voice, because it's really cute. It's called The Wild West. The man came walking tired, tired from his long journey. He thought he could see something behind him, creeping among the rocks. It seemed like it may be some snakes or something creeping up behind him. He went on towards his small little wagon, waiting for him, with his wife and three children. He sat down, had a cup of tea, and finished the rest of the day talking to them, telling them stories around the small fire beside the wagon with the horses. It was very hot, the evening was. Then the children went to bed one by one, each begging for another hour. But eventually, they all went to sleep, and the children were tucked in with their light sheets. And soon, they went to bed, too. Tomorrow would be another long day of labor, he thought, as he went to sleep.
And she's seven.
I really love it. It's got a very clear beginning and middle and end. It's got some suspense and drama, and it's got that beautiful detail of the children going to bed, each begging for another hour, and the man looking forward to, like, tomorrow is another long day of labor. I really, it's so sweet.
Yes. It was surprising to me, would you? Like, because some of those turns of phrases and the sound of the phrases, like the words together... the alliteration in them. I mean, yeah, it's really something. I was very impressed by it. She's seen you and Bella both writing poems.
That's true.
And so I think it's become.
And she's a few times she's had ideas that she's asked me to write down, but she kind of has forgotten the idea, like between the idea and writing it down, things get kind of lost. And so she's got one or two phrases, but the whole shape of it kind of gets lost.
Yeah.
And this is the first time she's really been able to get the whole thing down. I feel like there's a few places where she probably kind of lost a train of thought, like what was creeping up behind him. But still.
For a 7-year-old, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
I'm very impressed by that. So she's maybe the poet in the family.
She and Bella both.
Yeah.
It's really fun. I love it when kids start really wanting to write. And Bella hit that at about the same age. Actually, I would start writing down little poems and stories that she would compose long before she had the ability to really write them down for herself.
Mm-hmm.
But she had these big ideas that she wanted to get down and to be saved.
And now she and Sophie do writing together. Like we've talked about, like doing the Waddle and Slidey stories, which we've never done. We've never read a Waddle and Slidey story on the podcast. We've got to really get around to doing that.
We do.
Yeah.
And they also write like Star Wars fan fiction and Harry Potter fan fiction and that sort of stuff too.
Which is really what preteens fun. Do. They love to live in the universes that they enjoy.
Right.
So, yeah, it's really cool. So let's talk about food. You made a couple of cakes this week.
I did. I was really in a cake baking sort of mood.
Well, we had some celebrations. So
we did that too.
Friday was the Feast of St. Ignatius. That was Anthony Ignatius's feast day. Saturday was St. Sophia's. In addition to St. Alphonsus Liguori, it was also the optional memorial of St. Sophia. So Sophie's feast day. And then today is your birthday, but also Ben's baptism day. So there's lots to celebrate this week.
Right.
So you made a cake yesterday.
I did. I did not make anything for Anthony's. We just went to the store and got some
ice cream sandwiches.
Yes.
That he picked up.
Yeah, three baking days in a row. Actually, I did end up baking on Friday. I just made muffins and granola.
You did a lot of baking.
I did a lot of baking already, but it was more like just restocking the pantry sort of snack foods, breakfast foods sort of thing. Saturday,
mm-hmm.
yesterday, I made a peaches and cream cake. So I had all of these peaches that have been sitting on the counter for too long and they were mushy. Like nobody was going to eat these peaches. They were kind of gross, but not so gross that they really needed to be thrown away. Like they were salvageable.
And probably pretty darn sweet, actually, at that point.
Right.
Just mushy.
So I really wanted to, I think I talked about this on the podcast, the blueberry peach bread pudding that I made.
Yes, we talked about that last week. Yum.
I really wanted to make it again, but I did not have any bread that I could make bread pudding with.
Because you used all the bread the last time you made bread.
Right, exactly. I had the only bread I have in the freezer right now is some Asiago bagels that I'm saving for croutons, but it's not soup and crouton weather right now.
Right.
So I thought, well, if I did the same kind of peach topping, but put it like on a cake, that could be good. Right. That's kind of the similar ideas to bread pudding, like a layer of pastry and then a layer of, you know. So anyway, I found this recipe that looked perfect. It had a vanilla cake and then peaches layered on top of it, and then like a cheesecake topping, like a cream cheese whipped topping. But the recipe I found just had like plain sliced peaches from a can laid on top of the cake. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was kind of boring because I really still had in mind that rich cooked peaches from the bread pudding. So I decided to combine the recipes.
You combined three different recipes together.
I did.
Yep.
So the bottom layer was a vanilla cake. And then I had these cooked peaches. I cooked them with butter, brown sugar, cinnamon, nutmeg, and some amaretto in a skillet. And then I layered the peaches on, but I kept back some of the syrup that developed.
Yep.
And I whipped that with some cream cheese and a little bit of flour and some almond extract. And then I layered that on top And so it comes off, and then I sprinkle a little bit of cinnamon sugar on top just for fun.
Mm-hmm. And
it was so good.
It was really good.
Oh my goodness, it was so good.
So you've written up the recipe on your blog, so I'll put a link to that in the show notes in case anyone's interested, because then that'll have the bread pudding recipe as well. But yeah, that was peaches and cream cake. I mean, that was a really good idea. Your baking, you've really come a long way in your baking. Like, you've gone from, you know, tentative bread baking and, you know, making a few things here and there to really creating your own recipes.
You know, I laugh at myself because it's almost like I can't just follow a recipe. I'm like, I get an idea in my head and I think, well, I don't know exactly how to do that, but I could probably find a recipe that's kind of close and then adapt it. And I almost never bake just right off of the recipe card or the cookbook or the webpage. I always like fiddle.
Well, I mean, once you understand the principles, how things work, how they go together, then it becomes a lot easier. I mean, that's, you know, it's easier to kind of fiddle and to put things together without having to follow a recipe. I mean, most chefs and cooks will tell you that, you know, cookbooks are fine, but they're not, but you know, you really need to get to the point where you could feel the recipe come together. I mean, feel the force, Luke. You know, feel the recipe.
I mean, I'm not sure I'm quite there with baking.
Right.
But what I do have is I have these ideas of flavors that I want that I can't quite find a recipe for. And so I get a different recipe for the technique. Like, I don't know by memory or feel the proportions for a cake, but I can find a recipe for a cake and then change the flavor a little bit to be more like what I'm looking for.
Right. And then you made your birthday cake today.
Yes.
Because you didn't want me to get you a Konditormeister cake. And we already had one for Ben.
Yeah, we had one for Ben. And I've been craving carrot cake for months, honestly. But I wanted to make one, not just to buy one. And I think I've made carrot cake maybe once before in my life. So this was kind of a fun get to try something new.
Mm-hmm.
And get to do it exactly how I wanted it. So this was a homemade carrot cake, and it had, in addition to the carrots, it had pineapple, and I used currants instead of golden raisins, and I used pecans instead of walnuts. So a little bit more southern.
Right.
With my pecans, because I'm just not really a big walnut fan. And I made a cream cheese frosting for the top, which was just really good.
It came out really good. It was a good cake. That's for sure.
It was very, very.
It was rich, moist. It wasn't dry. Sometimes carrot cake can feel a little. Either carrot cake can be the really dry. It can be kind of dry, not really dry, but it has to be some moist. But so dry, a little dry, or way too moist, like rich. This was really a good in the middle.
Yeah, I was pretty pleased. I think the pineapple kind of helped to be moist, but not not over the top.
Yeah, yeah. It was good. So I made one thing new this week. It was kind of out of necessity more than anything. We'd had pasta, spaghetti, at some point in the last week. And we had a ton of leftovers, and we do again. Like, I don't know what it is, but suddenly they're not eating pasta as much pasta as they were before. So, but we had all this pasta leftover. No one was eating it, partly because we didn't really have much in the way of leftover sauce in the fridge.
Right.
I think that's part of it. Although Anthony doesn't eat with sauce. I don't know why they weren't eating it.
No, Anthony eats with sauce. He doesn't eat with cheese.
Oh, right. That's what it's.
Ben eats with cheese, but not no sauce.
Gotta keep track of them. So I wanted to use it up, and I was looking for something to have for lunch or dinner or something. I think it must have been lunch.
No, it was dinner.
Was it dinner? Oh, was it?
It was the dinner I made, like...
Oh, it was catch-as-catch-can. It was the night when you just weren't up for cooking.
I made, like...
Tuna.
Tuna for two kids, and I made quesadillas for a couple kids, and...
Yeah, we were just not up late. unless anyone gets the wrong idea, we're not, like, baking for, you know, cooking from scratch every night, like, woohoo, we're, like, you spend an hour and a half in the kitchen. There are some nights when it's, like, tuna for you, mac and cheese for you.
Right.
But I wanted to make something with, and I saw the pasta and I'm like, well, what can I do with this pasta? And I remember hearing before about a pasta, like a pasta frittata. So, and that's what I found a recipe, and this I tried. So you just drop the cold leftover spaghetti in a pan with some oil or butter, and you kind of heat it up. You're supposed to kind of like get it a little brown and a little bit crispy. I didn't really wait that long. I guess it might have been good with it with that way. And then you take a bunch of eggs and you add Parmesan or pecorino cheese and oil and salt and pepper, and you whisk them together.
Mm-hmm.
And then once the spaghetti, and in fact, they talk about using sauced spaghetti. So spaghetti with sauce, like starting that with that. I didn't start with that, but you could do that. And so if you have, once the spaghetti is ready in the pan, then you just pour the eggs over it, the egg mixture over it, mm-hmm. and then let it cook for a while and let it, you know, set up a lot. Now, the thing with a frittata is you can't cook it from the bottom to the top. It won't ever cook through like that from the stove. You'll burn the bottom before the top is set. So you have to flip it. So that's, a lot of people get a little, really hinky about flipping. And what you got to do is you got to put the plate over the thing and then flip it over and then slide it off the plate back into the pan. And I made the mistake of the plate not being big enough for the pan I was using.
Oops.
And dripped hot oil all over my forearm. That kind of hurt. But eventually I got it done. And then I had, what little sauce I had, I kind of put it on top of the pieces that I sliced out of it. And it was pretty good. It wasn't the best thing I ever had. And it needed something, but it was pretty good.
Maybe if you added like some herbs to it, like some basil or something.
And maybe if it was sauced pasta, like if it was like if you serve pasta with the sauce on at the table, which we don't do because, again, the aforementioned children who will not eat pasta.
Right, but in Italy, it's almost always served with the sauce.
Yes.
On the pasta. Like you wouldn't, they don't pass the pasta separately from the sauce.
Right. Exactly.
It's just weird.
Yes.
Yeah. Weird American thing.
Weird Americans. That I think that would have helped too. Yeah. But it was pretty good. It was a good way of using up leftover spaghetti that's not the normal thing, and using up eggs because we have a ton of eggs in the fridge. We've been actually getting better about using up the eggs. But at one point, I think we had 6 dozen eggs in the fridge.
Yeah, yeah.
We go to the farmer's market, the really nice farmer's market ladies there. We hate to go by her without buying eggs. It's just our thing.
I'm always ambitious, too. I think, well, this week we're just going to boil up a dozen or 2 dozen eggs for snacking on, and then I forget.
And then it's Friday, and it's like, or Tuesday, where it's time to reorder for the next week. And we're like, oh, should we order eggs? Yeah, I'm going to boil up those eggs. And then by Friday, mm-hmm. it's like, oh, I didn't boil up the eggs. But, you know, hey, we're going to have quiche. I'm making a bunch of cakes. We're doing something. But, yeah. The last food thing I want to talk about is something you picked up at the store on your way home from church today. You stopped for milk that we needed. But you got some chips, and you got Lay's Nashville hot chicken chips.
Yes.
Lay's is on this kick where they have these weird flavors that they keep shooting out to the markets for a little while. So
I have fun. Like when we go to the grocery store, I try to see if I can find a weird flavor of potato chip, and it's kind of like almost a game. Like, what weird flavor can we find to try this week?
What weird chips are out there today? I'm going to send you to an Asian grocery store at some point because they have all kinds of weird flavored snacks.
Really weird stuff.
Dried shrimp brine, whatever, the chips and stuff. But so when we went to Nashville a couple of years ago, we drove through. We were there for a couple of days. One of my big things is I love spicy chicken wings. One of my big things is I wanted to get a Nashville hot chicken sandwich. That's like Nashville. It's one of the things that's the food things are known for. And I'd read this article about it. And I kept seeing these things about it. I'm like, I really need to, like, I get kind of obsessive about certain mm-hmm. things. Yes. Mm-hmm. she's making that face where she puts her lips together tight and starts going, mm-hmm. And laughing at me.
Yeah.
I don't know what she's talking about. But I do get a little obsessive about certain things. Like I want to try the thing. I want this thing. It's in my head, and now I got to do it. And I never got one when I was there.
We were trying to accommodate other people's schedules, meeting up with friends, staying with my family.
It's funny how you often could, on our vacations that
we you never could have gone and got them. You never did.
Well, I would have had to have abandoned you all at the Nashville Pantheon to go find the.
Or you could have gone to do it like instead of going eating the dinner that everybody else was having or something like that.
I suppose I could have left the house and driven off and while you guys were eating. Whatever, that does not really sound like fun to me, but okay.
Nobody else wanted, like, none of the kids would have been able to eat the hot chicken, so you would have had to go off.
Stop at the place and buy it and bring it
back.
Yeah, I get it.
When we weren't
eating
it.
I get it. It just, I could have insisted, but it wasn't that important. As obsessive as I get, I wasn't that obsessed with it. If I was that obsessive, I would have gone for it and got it. But, so it wasn't that big a deal. But I was disappointed that I didn't get to try a Nashville hot chicken sandwich in Nashville. So, and then Kentucky Fried Chicken had them at their stores, and I got one there, and it was obviously disappointing because it's not the same thing.
It's no,
but
of course not.
So you brought these chips home, like, oh, this will be interesting. So what did you think of them?
It tasted surprisingly chickeny.
It did.
I was expecting it to be Nashville. Hot chicken, like spices, like the spices that you would get on the chicken.
Yeah.
But I wasn't expecting it to taste like chicken.
Like you put it in your mouth and you bite down and there's a very like front forward flavor
of chicken.
And that kind of goes away quick. So the chicken is up front.
Right. And then the spice is kind of at the end.
Yeah.
The spice was good. The chicken flavor was a little disconcerting.
It was a little off-putting. I won't lie.
I won't lie. I probably ate a dozen or so of them. And then I switched to regular plain potato chips. But Sophie really liked them. And she agreed that the chicken was a little bit weird and off-putting. But she couldn't stop eating them. And she has eventually ate the whole bag over the course of the afternoon.
An addictive substance and it didn't make it crave it fortnightly. Which is actually that's the KFC thing from Sorry, Murder and Axe Murder. Anyway. Surprisingly interesting, not my favorite thing, but I'd eat it.
Right. It was kind of the sort of thing that you find yourself eating, even though you're not 100% sure
that you really want to keep
really,
eating it.
Yeah. I'm kind of not unlike, actually, when a friend of mine who was teaching in Japan came back for a visit and brought squid jerky.
I told you, Asian grocery stores.
Right? I mean, I would not have picked it, and I wasn't really sure I liked it, but I found myself going back again and again.
Tons of amino acids, which means tons of umami. And umami, and I think that might be what explains this too, umami really is a flavor that you crave. I think, I love anything that's, like mushrooms and steak and anything meaty, that meatiness.
It's like you just can't help it.
Beef jerky? Slim Jims? Slim Jims are the worst.
I hate Slim Jims.
I love them.
They're so gross.
The one thing I'll stop at is the convenience store beef stick contains real cow tongue. I don't know. I don't want to know what's in that. Like Slim Jim, I'll avert my eyes from the ingredient list.
No,
but that little preserved beef stick thing, I'm not even going near. That's why I draw the line.
Yeah, you draw the line at a different place than me.
My line is much lower to the ground than yours.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I like beef jerky, though.
Even I have standards. They're substandards, but even I have standards. Uh-huh. All right. So that's the food thing. Do you guys have any recommendation for weird chip flavors for us to try? If you do, let us know.
Well, would I be able to find them?
Well, if it's something you've seen in a local grocery store or a convenience store or something like that. They may not have them here, but I want to hear about it.
I do want to hear about it. Yes.
Your friend Kira in Toronto, she goes to all the Asian stores
and
Japanese stores and gets all the weird stuff. So she's always got interesting tales of foods that she's eating. I say weird. You know, it's other people's culture. I respect it. It's still weird. I've got weird things, so no big deal. Let's talk about what we've been reading and watching. I want to talk about a movie I watched that I've been hearing about for years. It's called Ip Man.
Ip Man?
Yes. IP space MAN.
Oh, Ip Man. Okay.
It's a kung fu movie.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Starring Donnie Yen, who was, I keep forgetting to look up his name. He was in Rogue One. I am one with the Force, and the Force is with me. Remember that guy? The blind guy.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so he's Donnie Yen is a great martial artist. Really good, but well-known, been in a lot of movies. So it's the story of this guy in this Chinese village. I don't remember the name of it. In this province known for kung fu. Like far and wide, they're known for all the kung fu. They have martial arts schools, and they're like people come from all over. It takes place in the 30s, at least it starts in the 30s. And Ip Man, that's his name, is the foremost martial artist. But he doesn't run a school. He doesn't take students. He's apparently independently wealthy of some sort for however he is. But he maybe family money or something like that. He's got a wife and a son, and. And it's very interesting. You have these people who come and challenge him. The new head of one of the schools wants him to spar with him so that he can prove how good he is. You know, because he's got the school. If he can beat Ip Man, that means people will flock to him as his students. That sort of thing. And you know, they have a little duel, and of course, Ip Man is better. Yeah, but he's very gracious. He's very polite. He's very accommodating. He never shows someone up, you know, because he's better than him, that sort of thing. It's a very interesting, and it's apparently based on a true story.
A true story.
Of the man who was Bruce Lee's mentor.
Interesting.
So when World War II runs around, the Japanese invade China, and they invade this area. And so you have this story of Ip Man. He and his family are... They're thrown out of their house. They're homeless. They're trying to get by. The Japanese are killing people. They're treating them horribly. But the Japanese general of the occupying force, he's a martial artist, and he wants to see the best of the Chinese martial artists and compare himself to them and learn what he can from them. And he runs across Ip Man and sees how good he is and wants to challenge him and tries to hire him to teach his soldiers, his martial art, his kung fu. And there's a whole undercurrent story, a backstory or a B story about these criminals, these gangs who are terrorizing the people and taking advantage of them when they're already being taken advantage of by the Japanese. And so really good story. And then, this movie it's not just a typical kung fu movie, which doesn't have much of a plot, and it's all just a reason to string together a bunch of fights. There's actually a really good story in it. Like, there's a good plot. There's good character development in it. It was well done, and it was so well done that they've made three sequels to it. There's at least an Ip Man 4 out there, I guess.
But wow.
I don't think Donnie Yen is in the fourth one. I think he's only in the first two. He ends up in Hong Kong in the second movie. They've moved to Hong Kong after the war, I guess. But so interesting, interesting movie. It was on Netflix, which is how I was able to watch it. I think they're all on Netflix. So Ip Man was pretty good, I have to say. I like kung fu movies. I've watched some, and this was a good one.
Fun.
Something else I read this week that all of us, all the kids have read, that finally came, was a graphic novel called The Rise of Kylo Ren. It's a Star Wars graphic novel, obviously. It was supposed to come in beginning of April. I pre-ordered it. And because of the pandemic, it got kept pushed back, and finally it came. And so they've all been pouring over the thing, which is awesome, especially Anthony. And it tells the story of, if you've seen the Star Wars movies, the moment from when Luke tells a story in Last Jedi to Rey about how he felt the darkness in Kylo Ren and went to him in the middle of the night, and they had this battle, and that's what destroyed the Jedi Academy. So it tells the story from that point to how Kylo Ren became Kylo Ren of the Knights of Ren and what that's all about. And so that was an interesting filling in the backstory.
I still have not had a chance to read it because the kids have not let me get a hold of it yet.
Yeah. I do actually have to find it because what tends to happen is it gets secreted away, squirreled away in like a bed somewhere or under a bed or on the floor, and then the book gets destroyed. So I need to go rescue it at some point.
Yeah. Yeah. They're not easy on books.
Yeah. But it raises questions as well as answers some of them. There are some things I'm thinking, I ask myself, like, but why? And I think there's a little bit of...
Like, but why because they didn't think it through, or but why because there's still more story to be written?
I think some of them are plot holes. I think some of them are, they didn't think it through, and that this doesn't work, like, with everything else that they've already done, and now they're going to have to write their way out of it somehow.
Hmm.
But some of it is also just... You know, they're doing a thing, but you're not explaining why they're doing that. Like, why is that person? What is that person's motivation to do something that seems out of character there? That just see. There's a couple of things in it like that, and a couple of things where it feels like they're trying to round off the edges of Kylo Ren's evil. You know, when Ben Solo, because by the end of Rise of Skywalker, spoilers, Ben Solo is no longer Kylo Ren. And so he's now got to be a good guy. And therefore, we are rounding off the evil that he was at the beginning of Force Awakens, you know, where he slaughters a village of innocent people. You know, I feel like they're kind of, he does some things, some people die in this graphic novel, and they die sort of unintentionally. And it's like, I didn't mean to do that. Then they just died because of I was being emo Ben. You know?
Well, couldn't it be that they just are trying to show a progression of him getting darker?
It's possible.
Like Anakin in the prequels?
Well, not
that they did that well, but yeah. Like what they should have done with Anakin, which was a slow descent into from good guy to bad guy.
Which is what they should have done here, but it's not a slow descent. It's possible because by the end of the graphic novel, he's just full on doing bad things. Like he's fully become Kylo Ren. So it's possible they're showing a progression, but again, once again, like they did with Anakin, it's way too compressed. The time frame. Take the time. If this had been a conventional novel, there would have been the time to develop that. And they didn't have the time to develop that. But nonetheless, a good graphic novel. So what have you been reading?
A couple things. I'm on a Dorothy Sayers kick now because some of her books were cheap on Kindle this week. Always a good reason to pick up. I mean, I own them in paperback, but they're all kind of dusty and in a corner, and I'd have to dust them off and find them. So I bought Strong Poison and Five Red Herrings, and I finished Strong Poison, and now I'm in the middle of Five Red Herrings. Strong Poison is one of my favorites because it's the one where you meet Harriet Vane, who's the she's a mystery novelist, and Lord Peter, who's Dorothy Sayers' hero, he falls in love with her when she's on trial for murder, and he decides to try to get her off because he thinks she's innocent. But also, oh, by the way, would you marry me?
Okay.
He doesn't get the girl, at least not in that novel. It's just a really fun book. And Five Red Herrings, I like the premise. It's set in Scotland, and it's got the death of a painter. But there's a whole lot about train timetables that just, like, she got very excited about train timetables, and I just can't keep them straight in my head, so I don't really care, and I just kind of skim over the timetable stuff. But there's one artist is killed, and the suspects are five other artists, i.e. the five red herrings, and I just can't keep them all straight in my head. And it's not my favorite of her books. But I'm reading it anyway just to be a completist.
Train timetables. I'm not sure how that would fit into the book, but yeah. And the other thing you're reading?
Oh, one of my friends sent me a present this week, and I was very unexpected and exciting. It's called The Cooking Gene.
By Michael Twitty.
Yeah. Who is a historical reenactor, chef, who reenacts cooking
of the enslaved.
He himself
is African American.
He's an African American chef who got more and more interested in delving to his roots, his genetic roots and ancestral roots and family roots, but also the roots of African American cooking. And so it goes all the way back to the slaves who were brought to this country who became the chefs. I mean, he says at one point in the novel, Jefferson is credited for bringing all of these great dishes from France to America, but really Jefferson didn't cook it. Jefferson was not the cook. It was his slave, James Hemings, who Jefferson sent to learn French cooking while they were in Paris, who mastered French cooking and then brought it back to the U.S. And so this is a exploration of all the different origins of African-American cooking. And Michael Twitty dresses in costume and cooks at plantations in the South.
Historical plantations
as a reenactor alongside other reenactors. But there's a lot of, like, he talks about, like, there's a fad right now in American cooking, you know, of going back to your roots, you know, whether they be Italian or Irish or whatever. But for African Americans, their roots are trauma and painful. And yet he feels that it's really important to face that and to dig into that. And to he goes all in with the ingredients, the pots, the pans, the location, the costume, everything. But he's also feels like he's more challenged than other reenactors because he's not taken as seriously. He has to kind of prove himself above and beyond. So he gets into the science of it, the botany, learning the scientific names of everything, the historical names. All of these things woven together, his personal history, about his family, about reenacting, about the food, the recipes. It's this beautiful memoir with multi-layers, and it's beautifully written. His language is really just gorgeous. And a really fascinating history of cooking.
So I came to learn about Michael Twitty 3 years ago. On the Townsend's cooking channel, the James Townsend and Sons, or the guy's name is John Townsend, but it was called the James Townsend and Son cooking channel. John Townsend owns a reenactor supply store, basically, in Indiana, and has had this channel on YouTube for over a decade. And for most of it, a lot of it has to do with cooking of the 18th century and late 1700s. And so he went to George Mason House, I think it is. It's one of the founding fathers, George Mason, where he met Michael Twitty and did several episodes with him on some of the cooking that he does from that era. And so, Melanie and I, you and I watched the one on the barbecue.
Oh, that looks so good.
Yeah, he did barbecue, and he talked about, you know, the spices and the peppers and the things that they did and the different ingredients and how it varied from the late 1700s through the 1800s.
Right, he did a couple different barbecue sauces from different eras and showed, like, the progression of the flavors.
And the barbecue we know today, wherever it is, whether it's Texas or Carolinas or Memphis or wherever, all of those barbecues really have roots in the cooking of the African Americans, of the enslaved of those areas. They're the ones who really developed the sauces and the styles, and all the great pitmasters of the late 19th century, early 20th century were all black men.
Right. Which is interesting because there's a similarity in Jamaican cooking, as we kind of dived into Jamaican cooking with our local Jamaican jerk place around the corner. And that is also Jamaican cooking is also sort of a mixture of the African slaves in Jamaica.
But also
is a sort of a barbecue, but within with this peppers and the spices that they found from the Native Americans or the Native Indigenous peoples of Jamaica.
The Carib Indians.
Carib Indians. Yeah. Yes, that's what the word I was looking for. So, yeah, fascinating. I love learning about the history of cooking, and it's so many different layers going on.
It was also interesting because I later heard Michael Twitty on the Milk Street Kitchen radio show podcast with the, what's his name from, he was on America's Test Kitchen before.
Christopher Kimball.
And so he was on that, and Kimball was interviewing him, and it was about this book, The Cooking Gene. And one of the things he was talking about was going back to Senegal, which you probably haven't got to in the book yet.
Glancing through the book, it looks like that's actually the afterword.
Okay.
So that's way, way in the...
Okay. So he goes to Senegal to kind of track down his ancestors in Africa and track down their culinary roots as well. I mean, he kind of follows them based on the foods that he's aware of. So these people came from here, and this is the food that is the origin of the cuisine they created with the ingredients they had in the New World. And this is what it was. But he also talks about the people and encountering the people and the people, how the people view the descendants of the slaves from their country.
It's interesting because the one thing that I have got to so far in the book is that Michael Twitty's mom lived in Africa for a while as a young woman, I think like through her high school years. And so she brought back to his childhood these African...
Right.
She was a very bohemian cook, and she brought in all of these different recipes from all over the place, different sorts of cooking, very sophisticated cooking. And then there was his grandmother and his dad and his grandfathers who brought in this more traditional Southern cooking. So all the different layers of like how cooking is about your roots, but it's also about your family and their experiences.
Yes, most definitely. So good book. I mean, I haven't read it yet, but it sounds like a good book.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to finishing. I mean, I've read a chapter and a half so far.
Yeah, I can imagine it's a good book based on just Michael Twitty. It's an interesting person. So I would love to read it after you're done.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's what we've been reading and watching. Let's talk a little bit about some Catholic things. Let's talk about today's homily. Father Mike, our pastor, he gave a homily on this week's readings, which are on the feeding of the 5,000. But he took a different approach that I don't think I've ever really heard this sort of approach to it. No, he did not say the miracle was that everyone shared what they had. the tendency of some priests to downplay the miracle. No, actually, he approached it from the invitation in the Isaiah reading, and then just this invitation of Christ to sit and eat and to be with him. When he invites he goes off on his own because he's dealing with his cousin being killed. And then the people show up, and it's funny. It's kind of a very like parental moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
You kind of need a moment alone, and then the kids show up, and you're like, "I guess I'm the parent. They're the kids. They need me. I've got to set aside my needs right now to take care of them."
It feels like that's the prelude to the other feeding of the 5,000 too. He goes off to be by himself.
You mean in John 6?
Yeah.
The bread of life discourse.
Right. Yeah. He's also gone off to be by himself and is followed by the crowd. And then he takes pity on them because they're like sheep without a shepherd.
Right. In fact, they're kind of might be the same.
Same incident. Yeah. But that feeling of, I, as a parent, you totally.
Well, in fact, Jesus is constantly going off trying to get some alone time, and then the kids show up outside the bathroom door knocking on it.
Right.
Jesus, mom. Go ask your father. It feels very much like that. Well, so a couple of things that came out. One of the things that Father started talking about was the invitations. We get invitations. We're always getting invitations. He talks about he gets invitations. And he brought up a point, which is a very interesting thing that I think a lot of us should realize, is a lot of our priests are in a self-imposed isolation. At least around here, they're voluntarily isolating themselves from other people because they live generally alone or with a couple other priests, and they're isolating themselves from other people in order to be sure they're not exposed. They have to be even more careful than the rest of us because they can be potential vectors. If they get exposed or potentially exposed and have to go into a quarantine, they can't bring the sacraments to the people. So Father Michael's taking very seriously. He's like,
he talked about like somebody inviting him to go fishing or people inviting him to dinner and him having to say no. And then he talked about the invitations that he does accept. A young mom with a infant.
A newborn. Yeah.
Who was on bed rest and couldn't leave the house. And so he went to her and baptized both the mom and the baby.
Right. He didn't just tell any more of the story.
He didn't give the details about what was wrong or whatever. But
right.
But the idea is like that this is a vulnerable mom and baby. And if he was sick unknowingly and
right.
brought them a disease, you know, that could be potentially fatal for them.
If he was, you know, had been exposed and not necessarily sick, but had to be isolated from people, he wouldn't have been able to bring it. The sacrament to them. So very interesting. Keep that in mind with your priests. They're probably, and many of them are probably self-isolating. I mean, this is yet another sacrifice they're making for all of us. But he did go on to talk about God's invitation. Come to the table. Bring your gifts. Like the young boy who brought the 5 loaves and 2 fishes.
Even when your gifts don't seem sufficient.
Right.
What can I possibly give? This is not...
God always makes what you have sufficient for his mission. If he calls you and you say, Lord, I couldn't possibly do that. My gifts in this area are so weak. Remember, he took 5 loaves and 2 fishes and fed 5,000 plus women and children. So 5,000 men, you mean how much they ate, and then whatever the women and children ate, and had 12 wicker baskets left over. God will make you not just abundantly full, super abundant with the gifts that you need to do the mission that he's calling you to do. So that's one thing. And come as you are. Like, literally, just come. Just, like, if you're called, come. Come as you are.
Don't worry about whether you...
Right, whether you measure up, whether you're the right kind of person, whether you're holy enough, whether you're... whatever, just come. If he's calling you, he knows where you are and what you're like and what your faults are and what your worries are and all those things. He knows. Like, I got this, he's telling you. Just come.
Right. So then the other thing I read this week was our Cistercians that we've talked about before at Mount St. Mary's.
The Trappistine nuns.
Or Trappistine nuns.
Yeah, they're part of the Cistercians. So I'm sorry.
They had 2 events happen this week, sort of coinciding. This was supposed to be their week of retreat. And then one of the elderly nuns, Sister Perpetua, died this week.
She was 93.
She was 93. She had been in the monastery for 69 years.
69. She was it 69? Yeah, she was 69 there since years. 1951.
So, in a sense, they were, of course, sad to lose her, but this was a very long and full and rich life that they were celebrating at the same time. But Mother's reflection from this week's Lectio Divina was about sort of being in a similar experience to the one that the gospel describes of having gone into their retreat and then finding themselves pulled sort of out of the retreat, not fully, but spiritually being with Sister Perpetua in prayer on her deathbed as she died and then having her funeral and burial today.
Yesterday.
Wouldn't right.
It would be on Sunday. Yeah.
They had the burial yesterday, and the pictures were just beautiful. They made me cry. Just very lovely. The sisters, of course, prepare her. And they're.
It was very simple, of course.
Very, very simple.
Cistercians.
No coffin or anything, even.
Just on a platform that they just lower into the ground.
Right. And the sisters themselves do the work of carrying her to the gravesite and lowering her into the grave. There's something incredibly moving about that. Just, mm-hmm. They are bringing their sister and putting her to rest.
even in death, they are still together. They're a community. They're, and the, all the sisters who preceded them are there in the, on the grounds.
Right. And I actually noticed, I was poking around on their website, that they have a section on their site that gives the names and information and biographies of all the sisters who are buried there on the monastery grounds. And mm-hmm. There's two prior abbesses and I think like something like 20 something nuns there, and a couple of brothers too.
Right.
And it's just very beautiful. But this, again, this sense of God coming to them and asking them to bring what they had. And that she kind of talked about, like, as they leave the retreat, how to bring with them what they've gained from that experience of being set aside in prayer, and talking about it sort of as the image of these baskets full of fragments that are going to be able to sustain them later as they go about reentering their regular life of work and prayer. I thought that was interesting too, that there's all this food left over in the baskets.
What happens to the food?
What happens to that? Well, it's going to continue to feed Jesus and the 12, maybe?
Right.
So that,
and
this,
whoever else is with
them. So this mountaintop experience, this miracle, doesn't just feed people for today, but there's something left over to sustain them as they go up, as they leave the mountain, as they go off into the world to do more work.
It's one of the things that makes the reservation of the Eucharist and the tabernacle at the end of Mass biblical. Because, like, there are some who would say, oh, you know, whatever is, and in fact, I think some Eastern churches do this, whatever is consecrated at Mass must be consumed at Mass, is not left over. I think especially those who mix the precious blood in the host, that you can't just put that in the tabernacle. But the idea of putting in the tabernacle the wicker baskets full, the 12 baskets full, 12 baskets. Why 12? 12 is a number of the completion of the group of the, it's the 12 apostles and the 12 tribes of Israel. And 12 is a very important number to signify the totality of God's family. It's enough food left over to feed the family for a basket. We're probably, I'm not sure how big a wicker basket was, but probably not. It sounds like enough to feed for a while.
Maybe even at least for a day.
At least for a day, probably for a week. If you've got 12 apostles and 12 baskets, you probably get at least a week's worth of food.
So it's interesting. He takes the 5 loaves and the 2 fish and feeds the 5,000.
Plus
women and children.
Yeah.
But I hadn't really thought about, like, what happens to the food that's left over. Like, I always just saw the 12 baskets left over as, wow, look how amazing he is, that he didn't just give enough, he gave more than enough. But I didn't really think about, like, that as being something which is taken away, which continues to sustain.
Right.
Beyond the moment of the miracle into the rest of the mission.
Well, that's another, to extend that. When God gives superabundantly, it's not just to prove how great he is.
Right. It's not just for to show off.
Yeah. He's not just showing off, like, oh, I'm going to not just give you enough. I'm going to make you overflow. And then you can just leave that there. That's fine. I'll get it later. No, it's I'm going to make you overflow because that overflow will also be part useful. That'll be part of what we need to do.
Right. I it's kind of funny now that I think about it, like, that I never really considered the purpose, the meaning of that overflow beyond just how generous and amazing God is, sort of like the wine at the wedding of Cana. This is the best wine. It's kind of like, it's easy to think, well, that's just God saying, like, look how great this is. But there's something more to that if we dig into.
Right. It's the best wine because he wanted to make sure that the family was not embarrassed. He was giving them something special. In fact, when you watch The Chosen, which we have to do, that actually enters into how they portray it. And it's really kind of neat. Like, it's the best wine because it helps the family throwing the wedding. They would have been super embarrassed. They would have been super socially awkward and shamed in front of the whole community if they'd actually run out of wine.
Right.
That's a huge embarrassment. And in fact, what he does is he takes them from that huge embarrassment and makes them super well regarded. Like, wow, you people are so amazing. You're so generous. You gave us the not as great, like you gave us this good wine before and this amazing wine now. It's not just Jesus showing I'm the greatest vintner ever. I can make the best wine ever. You'll see for me. No, it was I'm doing this thing for them because my mother asked me to, and I love my mother, and therefore I'm going to do this nice thing for her friends. You know, that sort of thing. And I'm really looking forward to when they in Chosen, when they get to this gospel passage in creating it, because I really trust the filmmakers to pull this sort of idea out of it. Like, that it's not just superabundance for cool, awesome sake, but because Jesus is always going above and beyond to love the people around him, to care for them and give them what they need that they don't even realize they need yet. And that's one of the things I love about Chosen and the way they portray Jesus in it. It's not just, I am Jesus above you all. It's I'm Jesus. I really love you. And I'm really excited to do this cool thing for you. You know, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I can't wait for you and the kids to watch it anyway. I think that should wrap it up. We've been going on and on and on. So we want to, we are in danger of making this one of those podcasts that go from like an hour to an hour and 15 to an hour and 30 to 2 hours. I'm really trying to prevent that. So we do want to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including David C., Jordan S., David W., Guy R., or Guy, could be Guy, and Robert B. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. So that's it from us. What did you think of our discussion? If you have anything you'd like to share, any feedback you'd like to give us, and you can also send audio feedback like our good friend Zena did at the beginning, which was awesome. You can do so. You can comment at sqpn.com/bets or at the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. Or you can send an email and include, you can attach a little bit of audio you record with the voice memo function on your phone, say, to bets@sqpn.com, B-E-T-T-S at sqpn.com. And I'll put links to all the things we talked about in our show notes at sqpn.com. Be sure you subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, your favorite podcast app, or at the SQPN YouTube channel, where you should also hit the bell to get notifications. Until next time, I'm Don Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.